live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting live, but not video streaming live, from our studios in New York City. This is the one day a week that we reserve time for people to call in. That's why the program is called Call Talk Back. And today, in about 15 minutes, I'll begin taking your calls on any of the topics that you feel are important to you. You'd like to get more information or you'd like to share opinion. Our number is 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Today I'll be bringing you the latest on how we can increase our energy. I'll be talking about the branched chain amino acids, some new information from a Dr. Matilde Parente. And you've heard of the herb called rhodiola. Well, it does a lot to boost our energy. Dave Tuttle on that. And preventing age-related cognitive decline from Dr. Lori Barclays. Now, I'm going to be, if time permits, getting into a looming health crisis, the wireless technology, and how we are creating a toxic America from Professor James Tracy from Global Research. Also, I'm going to address some of the people who are called the Quack Watchers and give you some insights on them, and particularly a Stephen Barrett. So I'll share that with you. And then I'm going to try to make an understandable overview of something I tried to do this past week but didn't have the time. I had on a Robert David Steele, a very nice man, who has a lot to share. And he was trying to introduce us to the open source philosophy. Now, open source is how we could use the intelligence of the collective global brain of humanity to influence change in government, business, and society. Is it possible? Well, I'll share that with you and see if it makes sense, all right? But let's begin. I was concerned that the media was focusing and is on the use of the weapons in the Colorado shooting, and instead of focusing on what I think is more important, and that is what causes a person to go so far out of the boundaries of normal that they're willing to commit such a homicidal act with virtually indifference emotionally. But there's a long history of this, and almost in all cases the people are on antipsychotic or antidepressive medication. When you look at it as carefully as I have, and I'm just finishing a major study on it, as well as a documentary, you'll see that the actual effects are to change our brain chemistry. And therefore, I believe that we should be focusing attention on how many people who've killed other people were on psychiatric meds. When you realize it's over 95%, that's 95%, then you have to bring in the pharmaceutical companies, the regulatory agencies, the National Institute on Mental Health. All of these become co-conspirators in keeping this information from being the point of attention. So Martha Rosenberg, who I had on this program several months ago, wrote an article for Counterpunch, and it's called The Mind Druggers. Psychiatrists reaffirm their loyalty to Big Pharma at an annual meeting. Now, because we filmed at this meeting recently, and I'm going to one day this week put some of that information up so you can watch it on Gary Null TV. By the way, we've been getting about almost a half million people a day going over to Gary Null TV to see all the different television episodes we have up there. Because each week, whenever I'm filming something, I will take the extended interviews that will not be in the film and put it up there for you to see. For example, this past week, I filmed up in Canada. I filmed a man named Percy, who has fought Monsanto and won in a classic battle. In the film, the documentary I'm doing on genetic engineering, with about 53 other people who are in the film, he'll get about 2.5 minutes. But there's a 50-minute interview, and you'll be able to watch it starting on Monday. And also, I went to the farmer's market to film a little segment on locally grown foods and herbs that can help turn off pain in the body. That's 50 minutes long, and that'll be up tomorrow also, even though in the film it'll only be about 2 minutes. So each week in my travels, I'll be posting important information for you to be able to see that otherwise you wouldn't. So anyhow, the American Psychiatric Association's annual meeting was in Philadelphia this year. 11,000 psychiatrists attended. And instead of caring about what the public has been saying about our overly medicated children and the soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq, all the senior citizens who are on meds, and just regular people who are watching television and being influenced by the ads they have on there, the American psychiatric community reaffirmed its resolve to pathologize healthy people on behalf of Big Pharma. This is the year that the American Psychiatric Association puts the final touches on the DMS-5. That's a comic book. No, it's not meant to be a comic book, but it has no more credibility or science to it than a comic book. It's a complete and total fraud. There is nothing in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual that is aligned with actual science or true diagnostic measures. And yet, as this compendium that determines what treatments insurers will cover, what disorders merit funding as public health threats, and of course pharma marketing and profits, I question the objectivity of any disorder, and that they cannot prove any disorder, not a single disorder can they prove, is an imbalance in the brain chemistry. A, they have no way of measuring that, and B, they have no way of controlling what their drugs will do when you bring a serotonin down to almost zero and then artificially give your serotonin, and then suddenly a person freaks out. Further, the appearance of the self-dealing is the revelation that 57% of the authors of the Diagnostic Statistical Manual number 5 have pharmaceutical links. 57%. And do you know how they actually determine if something is now a legitimate scientific psychiatric diagnosis? They vote on it. A consensus, a show of hands. But what actual hard evidence do they have? None. Not a scintilla. Nothing. Zip. I'm not kidding. That's the facts. Scheduled presenters at this year's meeting, including former American Psychiatric Association President Alan Schatzberg and Dr. Charles Nemeroff, both investigated by the Congress of the United States for murky pharmaceutical income. Nemeroff's $9.3 million National Institutes of Health grant to study depression was suspended, which happens rarely, when the government found out he had simultaneously taken $1.2 million from the antidepressant manufacturer GlaxoSmithKline for Paxil. Nemeroff, oops, well, that's what happens, but now he is again basking in taxpayer money, recently awarded a $2 million 5-year grant from the National Institutes of Mental Health to study, quote, the prospective determination of psychobiological risk factors of post-traumatic stress disorder, end quote. And Schatzberg and Nemeroff are co-editors of the American Psychiatric Association published textbook of psychopharmacology, whose edition cites the work of Richard Borison, a former psychiatric chief at the Augusta Veterans Affairs Medical Center, who was sentenced to 15 years in prison for a $10 million clinical trial fraud. Also scheduled at the meeting was maker AstraZeneca, which were believed to alter his scientific conclusions. And speaking of Seroquel, despite Assistant Secretary of Defense Jonathan Woodson's recent memo to all military branches about the overprescription of such antipsychotics, which include Risperdal for post-traumatic stress disorder, military figures linked to Seroquel were also scheduled presenters at the American Psychiatric meeting. And Dr. Ritchie, who told the Denver Post that Seroquel, quote, was very useful for the treatment of anxiety and combat-related nightmares, end quote, though it was and is not approved for such treatment, while she was a medical director of the Army Strategic Communications Office, and she was a scheduled presenter. how much are they paid for being a presenter? Richie is now Chief Clinical Officer for the District of Columbus Department of Mental Health, and she appeared in an AstraZeneca and Eli Lilly-funded webcast for the Massachusetts General Hospital Psychiatric Academy, in which she lauds the use of, quote, sophisticated psychiatric medicines on the battlefield. Well, can you name me one? Can you name any study you've done? Has anyone done showing taking a group who've never had a problem and a group who have post-traumatic stress problems or some form of problem on the battlefield and then work with them, one using a placebo, one using this drug, and then by an objective means of measuring the difference? No, you can't. It hasn't happened. So then how can you make a statement? Seroquel, which carries heart warnings and is linked to sudden cardiac death, earned AstraZeneca $6 billion in last year. That's according to the Philadelphia Inquirer. Quote, IMS Health, a healthcare information service company, said that in the 12 months ending in February of this year, 14.1 million Seroquel prescriptions were written, more than any other antipsychotic, end quote. Also participating in the military and post-traumatic stress disorder content at the American Psychiatric Association meeting was Matthew Friedman, executive director of the VA's National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, who reported, quote, I received an honorarium from AstraZeneca in the past year. Did you? How much was it? And why would anyone from the government, who is instrumental in either promoting or greenlighting the use of any drug, be allowed to go to a group of psychiatrists, the leading ones in the country, and promote that? How much were you paid? That's a gross conflict of interest by any term. He has also served as a Pfizer visiting professor at the Medical University of South Carolina College of Medicine last year, and he's listed in the American Psychiatric Association meeting guide as having, quote, no significant relationships to disclose. The APA officials have not resolved to make any comments. So what you have is you have elaborate multi-drug cocktails prescribed to our troops suffering with post-traumatic stress disorder who are not just dangerous and have never been tested as combinations. They're capable of making troops with traumatic brain injuries and chronic traumatic encephalopathy, signature Iraq-Afghan injuries, worse through alterations in brain chemistry and the blood-brain barrier. And the American Psychiatric Association presenters had another recommendation for Seroquel, a treatment for the nation's millions of alcoholic and drug addicts who are next on pharma's radar. So in my opinion, my personal opinion, the American Psychiatric Association is a joke. They're a bunch of fools. The psychiatrists have no scientific basis at all. They're a bunch of drug pushers, and shame on everyone in the United States that accepts money from the psychiatric associations or the pharmaceutical companies supposedly helping people deal with depression and anxiety disorders or bipolar, all of which are a fraud. Everything about this is a fraud. One giant con game. And yet the public is vulnerable and continues to believe in this. So will they actually look into the truth of the psychiatric drugs this person was on? Well, later this week, I will publish a 65-page resume of all the mass killers in the last 30 years, all on antipsychotic or antidepressant medication. Next up, raw almonds. Raw almonds. Raw almonds must soon be steam heated or treated with a toxic chemical. That's what we were told. There is a way to get some almonds that have not been processed, but there's a major battle going on to try to challenge the FDA so that you don't have to have fumigation of the almonds. Get the organic almonds and make sure that when you speak with people who sell almonds, that they have some guarantee that the almonds have not been fumigated, and raw almonds cannot be fumigated. That was a question someone had asked me. Now, the neem leaves can fight the HIV virus. This is from Keene University, and here's what it says. Dr. Arora, a professor at Keene University in New Jersey, is delving into understanding the curative properties of the neem tree, N-E-E-M, in fighting the virus he says that causes AIDS. She says, her preliminary results indicate, quote, that there are compounds in neem extracts that target a protein essential for HIV to replicate. If further studies support her findings, Aurora's work may give clinicians and drug developers a new HIV/AIDS therapy to pursue. Now, what we know is that the extracts from neem leaves and the bark and the flowers are used throughout the Indian subcontinent to fight against pathogenic bacteria and fungi. You can go on almost to any village in southern India, and you'll find that they have taken the leaves and the bark, and they make all kinds of things from them. It's used in remedies, natural Ayurvedic medicine. And it's a combination generally used with others to control diabetes, but now it's good, so we'll look more into that. And to maintain your brain, there's some new information from mainstream science. And I'm always interested how far away are they to catching up where we're at. Here's what they're saying. Aging may seem unavoidable, but that's not necessarily so when it comes to the brain. So say researchers in the issue of Cell Press Journal's Trends in Cognitive Sciences, based on counterintuitive evidence that is what you do in old age that matters when it comes to maintaining a youthful brain rather than what you did early in life. Quote, although some memory functions do tend to decline as we get older, several elderly show well-preserved functioning, and this is related to a well-preserved youth-like brain, end quote. And that's from professor of neuroscience at Umeå University in Sweden. Now, education won't save your brain. PhDs are as likely as high school dropouts to experience memory loss with old age, the researchers say. And don't count on your job either. Those with a complex or demanding career may enjoy a limited advantage, but those benefits quickly dwindle after retirement. Engagement, I repeat, engagement is the secret to success. Those who are socially, mentally, and physically stimulated reliably show greater cognitive performance with a brain that appears younger than its years. Quote, there is quite solid evidence that staying physically and mentally active is a way towards brain maintenance. So, what's the takeaway message here? The takeaway message is that create projects that challenge you. Do something that you don't have to do, that people would say, why are you doing that? And then you say, because I want to be challenged intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, and then engage in that. And that's how you keep your brain younger. Now, I'm going to go a little step further on this because that's where they're at, and I respect that, and that's good. But we know, according to the work of Dr. Laurie Barclay and many others in the field, that impairment of memory and learning does not have to come along with the aging process. You've heard me mention many times, there is no disease normal to aging. Arthritis, fibromyalgia, high blood pressure, macular degeneration, cataracts, none of those are normal. They may be average, but they're not normal. Susceptibility to age-related cognitive decline happens when we are not actively engaged in preventing. Now, there's a lot of studies. I probably have 2,000 to 3,000 studies because I have a new book coming out on, actually two books on aging. There was so much material to write about, and these are big books, 800 pages and 700 pages, 1,500 pages. And one's just on the brain. These will be out in the late fall, that prove you can virtually stop and reverse cognitive decline, memory loss, and a particularly intriguing development in the field of brain health and longevity occurred with the release of a Canadian study on the use of a combination of different supplements. And using a transgenic mouse model of aging, researchers discovered that there are about 31 different nutrients that used together can make an enormous difference. And because they were doing specific studies using the transgenic mouse versus a regular mouse, and the transgenic mouse was dying quicker until they gave them these nutrients. And we have to understand that with increasing age, untreated transgenic mice were dramatically worse, while as the treated transgenic mice grew progressively better in terms of their number of errors and attempts required to learn a maze, almost 250% better. So what? I'll give you just some of these, which will at least give you some help here. Up at the top of the list are DHEA. I mentioned that last week, our mother hormone from which so many other hormones are made. Melatonin, to take at night. Vitamin B1, B3, B6, B12, and folic acid. Very important superstars, acetyl-L-carnitine, alpha-lipoic acid, and coenzyme Q10. Vitamin C, vitamin E, beta-carotene, green tea, glutathione, and N-acetylcysteine. Also, flaxseed oil and cod oil. And then ginkgo biloba, ginger, chromium, magnesium, potassium, selenium, and zinc. And the ginseng, bioflavonoids, garlic, and rutin. Now, those are the 31 nutrients. Those are good, but those are not the best. For those of you who are up to date on all your compounding powders, take a look at what you're using. Then look at the scientific literature on each one. And you'll see that with the exception of DHEA, acetyl-L-carnitine, alpha-lipoic acid, coenzyme Q10, melatonin, vitamin C, N-acetylcysteine, flaxseed oil, ginkgo, and ginseng, there are at least 35 other plant-based nutrients that are maybe 10 times better than these, but it shows us kind of where everything's at this moment. I'm Gary Noll. That's our Health and Nutrition Report for today. Now, let's take a look at a few other things that are here. I had a guest on recently, and I felt that he has a lot to share. But in that particular interview, just wasn't able to put it into something succinct. The emphasis went towards promoting a book, and sometimes when you have someone on that's promoting their book, they may not be fully aware that in the medium, when radio, if you say, oh, in my book, it doesn't mean that someone can actually go and buy the book or will. So my preference, as always, is succinctly explain to us what it is that's in your book, and then if I find it unique or interesting, then we'll explore it beyond that, each and every point. So here's what I at least understand the open source to be, and the open source philosophy. I just don't know how well it would work. Now, keep in mind that one of the things we're not doing today is we're not addressing any of our major environmental problems. We're not addressing our political problems. We still have the tyranny of a two-party system. And yet we have at least 9 different legitimate parties. And yet only 2 are allowed on the ballot. And yet Congress has mandated that all federal elections include all 8 parties on the ballot. But it doesn't get done. And the Congress also should be mandating that all debates for federal elections include candidates from all 8 parties. That should be done. But I'm concerned that we not just have a Democrat and Republican Party, but we also have a Green Party, and we have a Libertarian Party, we have the Justice Party, we have a Reform Party. There's some that are minor, like the Natural Law Party, but we should be able to hear from all these. And I believe that if we did it this way, it would be We would not be losing the integrity of the political system. Ban all funding, 100% funding, from any private source at all. Make all elections supported by the public. Have a 3-month voting cycle, and anyone who wants to run for election from any party, then submit their platforms on all the issues that are important, and then let the public read it. And then have a spokesperson, your most articulate spokesperson, then go make a presentation on each one. And then we can share that. And even public television and commercial television, cable television, would be mandated that they must play a certain number of these equally from each individual or party. And then we could have unlimited amounts of information up on her website, providing that it's all equal. So one person doesn't have 10 times more information than someone else. That way a cab driver or a school teacher or baker or police officer could have the same opportunity to run for office as one of these individuals who have $1 billion behind them. And then the public votes. And then you vote in twice. You vote first and for the people that you want, and then you eliminate everyone else, and then you have debates and dialogues between them. And that would be a good way. And that's one way. At least we would return to a representative government. Then have single terms only. Every office in America, no matter if it's a mayor or a state legislator, you can only run once. You can only hold a seat once. And then you cannot go out and lobby for the next 10 years. You have to stay out of lobbying. And that way, let them run and be in office for 2 years. That way, we're always getting new ideas, new change. Then I believe that we should have oversight in complete transparency of every bureaucracy in government, federal, state, and local. Do you realize that the most conservative estimate I come up with is 50% waste in every single agency of government, and in the Department of Defense it's up to 80%. Self-dealing, insider corporations, it's all corrupt. Could you imagine if we were able to save that money for the American public and put that into better education, rehabilitation of our schools, and really go into the inner city, not just to put up a new building, but to actually support infrastructural change, maintenance, and have the clinics and have the services that help people on the ground, and not controlled by bureaucracies, but by in the community nonprofit groups. And then you would save about $2 trillion a year. Also, we should return as many rights as possible back to the states. The federal government has become a monstrous bureaucracy, corrupt at every level, exceeding any of the powers our original founding fathers were to give them, and they're virtually controlled, everything is controlled, by this two-party corrupt system. And we should demand constitutional conventions, but we have to first rebalance this process of electing our state legislators, and then rebalance how we go about hiring or selecting our national leaders. I believe that in order to engage a universal brain, it must be a grassroots effort up. I no longer have any confidence in any of the major organizations, including environmental or foundations, because they become elitist. They are easily corrupted. Time and again, the very people who are supposed to be working on our behalf are working for their own interest. If you doubt me, look at Haiti. 99 cents out of every dollar that was donated for Haiti relief stayed in the United States or went to these NGOs. It did not go to help people on the ground. I think we've had enough of this. I think that we have to trust local grassroots organizing. And then you empower the vast majority of people. You empower the majority of Americans. So you create some equality between those who right now feel they have no power and those who control all power. I also have said this many times. I believe that we should have, in every agency of government, a truth and reconciliation panel. I believe that we should have independent jurists go in and go back as many years as possible in every agency of government and root out corruption. And if they do not tell the truth and show us the full extent of what they did, they should be put in prison. Let's see, it worked in other countries. Why not have it work here? I also believe that we should have to re-examine again what is important. Right now, possessions, money, power, conquest of nature, exploitation of other countries, globalization, free market enterprise, that's the dominant pyramid. But what if you turn that pyramid upside down and now you had new priorities like consciousness and supporting empowering movements and having high-quality examination of the products and services we receive to see are they safe, are they effective. And I believe that we should then look at how we've been enabled and stop it. We should support the small business people. We should support the small farmer. We should support the artists in our communities. And we should, in effect, re-engineer for a new urban renewal, bringing into the urban environment the lessons that have not been learned when, after 1945 through the 1970s, the movement was to the suburbs and the inner cities became ghettos. We could spend a lot of time and energy de-ghettoizing America. I also believe that we should challenge the monopolies and trusts that now exist that control everything. And I think that would make an enormous difference. I think we should look for new leadership, new ideas, and let people decide. Right now, our leaders decide. The bureaucratic heads of agencies decide. The private, all related at some level ideologically, through the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, and Bilderberg Group, they decide for us. And then they have their people go out and sell it to us, whether it's a war in Iraq or the justification for intervention in Iran on behalf of Israel. These are not benefiting any of us, but they benefit the elite, the people who control the international policies and the arms industry. So we have to break that old paradigm, and we have to go towards a new paradigm. And for that, we need complete transparency. And if not, then we have to start resisting everything they do from the local level to the national level. So when you look at all the different agencies that need complete transformation, the military-industrial complex, the financial industry, the media, academia, social services, the corrupt nonprofit groups most, the corporate agenda where they're sitting with $23 trillion in offshore accounts because they don't want to pay a tax to bring the money they made elsewhere back in the United States, the corrupt law enforcement, the militarization of our police. With a global brain, these same principles would work everywhere. Take away their power, and we take away their power by stop funding them, stop respecting them, stop obeying their orders. Because right now we're a world of corruption, and fragmentation is killing us. They keep us fighting each other based upon ideologies that are stupid. They have made science and proprietary science above all their truth, and we're supposed to believe it. Hence, we're told to get vaccines that don't work. We're supposed to eat the basic four food group as if it gives us health. And then we're supposed to take their drugs and medical treatments as if it makes a difference. It does not. So, for the 75% of the world's population who each day, through what they buy or where they work, directly benefits the small percentage of the multinationals and the people who control those, we have to, at some point, say no more. No more buying their products. No more letting them look away from poverty. No more having them exploit us with student loan debts and credit card debts and home foreclosures. We have a right and an obligation to stop their proliferation of financial and political terrorism. And that is what we can do when we have the courage to turn off the television, find our conscience, and join our conscience with global conscience. At least that's my interpretation. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment with your calls. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. welcome you. I'm Gary Null. We're going to go to our calls now. Our number is 888-874-4888. Nice to have you with us. And also, we have this new service. It's a phone service. And that way, anywhere in North America or Canada, when you're outside and you can't stand in front of a, you know, sit in front of a radio and listen, we have a, this, you just call 832-280-0066. 832-280-0066. Let's say hello to Suzanne in Edmonton. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Gary. I've just been diagnosed a week ago with invasive lobular carcinoma of the breast. I'm really in the dark here. I've been listening to your program for about 2.5 years, so, and have always eaten a fairly healthy diet, I think. I just have no clue where to turn to, and I'm reading all kinds of things about the radiation effects and chemotherapy effects and even a mastectomy, and I would just like to know, first of all, what immediately I can do in terms of high-dose supplements to boost my immune system, and what your eventual prognosis or where to turn to might help.
All right. Have you watched the 4.5-hour special documentary I did this year called Preventing and Reversing Cancer Naturally?
No, I have not.
Okay, that would be the first thing, because then my whole protocol is in there, along with the people who are the holistic medical doctors, including holistic oncologists, who each have a different approach, but they are all complementary. So
okay.
you could take all of them, and the more you take, the greater your chances of reversing cancer. Now, that's
okay.
That's from what you'll get there. But then you also have to have, and I suggest anyone with cancer, work with a person who has a background in the field, either nursing or medicine or clinical nutrition, who can help you understand the history. A lack of exercise, of viruses, of alcohol in any amount, of socioeconomic status, environmental pollution, the poor diet, obesity, smoking, all of these, even carcinogens in the workplace, all these have some role to play in causing the cells to alter. Because it's one thing to say, well, okay, what if I start taking a lot of vitamin C? Well, okay, but what if you're also at the same time under stress, and therefore cortisol is going to do more damage as you're stressed than vitamin C would do positively to protect you? That's why you can't do it episodically. You have to do it in a very holistic way, in a very patient way, and taking your time. You have to change your blood chemistry over to being on a high alkaline diet. And because each thing you do, for example, if you had a lymphoma, that's a cancer affecting the lymphatic system, or leukemia, cancers of the blood-forming tissues, or sarcomas, cancers that affect muscles and connective tissues and bones, or carcinomas that affect the skin and mucous membranes and glands, each one is going to be impacted by what you do in a constructive way. So you're going to have to look at immunologic therapies, herbal therapies, metabolic therapies, biogenic therapies, mind-body therapies, and nutritional therapies. So it's not as simple as simply taking, what vitamin can I take? If you've been listening for 2.5 years, then you know the approach I take. It's very methodical. It does not rush. Whether it's the Hoxie formula, which was first tested in 1920, that use internal and external herb preparations, or the immunological therapies that help the immune system, boost the immune system, that combats and destroy cancer cells. As you know, I believe that Dr. Joseph Issels has and had the best overall whole-body immunological therapy of anyone. But then there's Dr. Ravisi's metabolic therapies, anabolic and catabolic. So that's why, first and foremost, go up online and read all the articles I've written. I've written 663 articles, and a lot of those are on cancer. And I'm always updating them. Even if I wrote some of them in the 1970s, I always update. So get yourself educated. All right? Then if I said, okay, you start to improve cellular oxygenation because it facilitates coenzyme Q10 at 1,000 milligrams helps facilitate oxygenation, but coenzyme A also facilitates RNA and DNA repair and supports the immune's detoxification system. At least you'll understand what I'm talking about. Otherwise, it's just a random group of inositol hexaphosphate, IP6. It has powerful anti-cancer properties, and it helps stimulate natural killer cell activity. But you can't take something out of context and expect it to all blend together. That's why I would like to see everyone take their time and take a holistic approach, all right?
Okay.
All the best to you.
Thank you.
And let me know how you're doing. Keep in touch. Let's take another call here. Let's say hello to Al from Long Island. Hi, Al.
Gary?
Yes, hi.
With the able assistance of your staff, no one has done more to bring health information of the highest quality to the American people. And your investigative reporting has expanded the consciousness of the people and foreign people as well. By bringing the facts before our nation and demolishing the mythology of the government and corporate media. However, my question pertains to your guests who analyze the economy, politics, and foreign policy and make recommendations. Here you have raised a level of discourse in our nation in two ways. By one, exposing the narrow breadth of political and economic opinion permitted by the corporate media, and here I include public broadcasting, and its exclusion of topics that threaten corporate or government interests. And two, by bringing outstanding commentators onto your broadcasts and films that are ostracized by corporate media. As you have often stated, everyone deserves a seat at the table. Gary, this is my question to you. Haven't you also practiced exclusion? I can understand excluding representatives of criminal enterprises, the Communist Party, the Nazi Party, and here I include the Republican and Democratic parties as well. However, I cannot recall a nonpartisan neocon or democratic socialist ever being interviewed on your broadcasts.
Well, Al, let's examine the challenge you're offering. First and foremost, never once in my entire career do I look at someone based upon their political affiliations or their political ideologies as a reference for having them as a guest. So I never ask anyone, are you affiliated with the Marxist or Leninist or communist or socialist or libertarian movements? And that's not what's important here. That's never been important. If I did that, then I would have to exclude every doctor if that doctor did not align with some artificial notion of a utopian social or philosophical view of life. And I don't do that. So you're asking me a question with the assumption that somehow I haven't had a particular type of person on. When I have people on who have ideas, nothing else concerns me. I don't care about their race, their religion, their body politic, their sexual preference. None of that is concerning me. All that's concerning me is, do they have insights and information that will empower us? Simple. All right? But I appreciate the challenge, Al. Just didn't work this time. We'll take another call. Let's say hello to Luann. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. You know, I know that you have a lot of new listeners coming on board, and doesn't surprise me in the least, but I wonder how many people know that you've done a phenomenal documentary piece on Black Hollywood, the evolving role of the black population in our entertainment, especially in... I found a copy of this DVD that I had gotten some time ago, and it is just phenomenal. And I ask you, will you, since so much has changed since that documentary was done, are you considering doing yet another one?
The answer is no, I'm not, because there's no need for it. When I did Black Hollywood originally, each day I would go to the Schoenberg Collection, the County Cullen Library up in Harlem, and I would, there was no computers then, there was no cell phones, this was back in the early 70s, and I would read the literature, I'd read articles and books, and one day there was a woman sitting at the table, and she was coughing, and I suggested a simple remedy to her. And I wrote it down, and I gave it to her, And I said, this might help you. And about 2 days later, she came in. She says, that really helped me. She says, I didn't know that. And she says, what kind of work are you doing? I said, well, I'm writing three separate books, one on the Native Americans called Stopping the All-American Genocide Machine, and one on the history of African Americans in motion pictures. And but I'm having a difficult time finding them because they're almost all, with the exception of those who are in Hollywood now, they're retired. And mind you, back then there was no database. There was no Google. There was no way to find these people. And who had been in films, now we're not. And she said, well, she said, I have a friend that you ought to meet. And about 2 weeks later, this woman introduced me to a woman. And that woman's photograph, along with her husband and several others, you can see up on my website. I did a radio show then. And it was Lorenzo Tucker and his wife. And Lorenzo Tucker was considered the Black Valentino. Extraordinarily charming and handsome. And his producer was considered the first Black independent producer in Hollywood. And Oscar Micheaux. And he would make films in Central Park. And he would go down to the South where there was segregation. And he would get money from the African Americans in a community, then he would ask them, what kind of film do you want to see? Do you want to see a Western, a gangster, what kind of film? Singing, musical? And then they'd tell him what they wanted, and he'd go back and he'd produce the film, and then he'd bring it down and show it. And that's how he made his money. But he also founded a lot of people. There were an awful lot of actors and actresses who got their start in his films. Well, then they started to introduce me to other people, and then one day this woman they bring in, she's an elderly woman, and there's a photograph of her, Anita Bush. She was the first African-American to appear in a motion picture, The Crimson Skull. And then I was begin to work with him every day. And Miles Kruger, who was a friend, who's one of the most famous film historians in the United States and still is, he was fascinated because I was telling him all the stories. And I was getting to meet all the famous African-Americans. I was finding people, Paul Robeson and anyone who was still alive, even though many were sick, and some were in hospitals, and I had to travel to Chicago to see one, and Memphis to see someone else. But here they were, because society had forgotten them. Time had come and gone. And yet, years later, decades later, they were still alive. Now, there were some, like Lena Horne, who was alive, and Brock Peters, a wonderful actor. You'll see his picture there in the studio where I was interviewing him. I interviewed about 600 people, lots of people. And then I wrote the book, and the book became very, very popular. And especially since, I remember when Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee were having me on his show, and it was a radio show, and he was, it went on and on and on. It was a long interview, and he thought I was African American, and I never thought anything about it. And I said to him, because he said, you know, you have a very Caucasian voice. Where are you from in the South? And I said, I'm from West Virginia, just south of the Mason-Dixon line. And I mentioned to him that I'm Caucasian, though I have a very strong Native American background. It's in my family, my grandfather and others. And he didn't know that. He was very surprised by it. And then I asked him a question. I said, since I'm a big believer in promoting minority rights and American Native rights, should it be excluded that only an African American could write a book on African Americans? If you're going to tell me yes, then I'm going to walk back through that door at you. And so we had this whole debate, but the book went on and did extraordinarily well, became a bestseller. Then one day I get a call. And it was from Mel Berg, my manager over at the Wayne Morris Agency, or not my manager, my agent. I believe he went on to become president of Wayne Morris Agency. And he said, Gary, he said, good news. The book sold to Newsweek and MGM. I said, which MGM? Well, MGM, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. And Jack Haley Jr., and I said, Jack Haley Jr., wasn't his father in the Wizard of Oz? Wasn't he the Tin Man? He said, yeah. Well, that same Jack Haley, who was president of MGM, he loves it. So then he was married to Liza Minnelli at the time. So we had all these meetings, And then word got around that we were producing, because he had produced That's Entertainment, part one and part two, so we were going to have like a That's Entertainment of the African-American Experience. And that's when I brought in Godfrey Cambridge, who I thought was an extraordinarily talented writer and director and actor, not just a comedian. And I had planned to have a famous African-American host each decade, so that Lena Horne would do one, and Harry Belafonte would do one, Sidney Poitier would do one, go clear back through history. And we'd agreed upon that. I was writing the script. And at the time, I said, you know, there are a lot of other African-Americans. I wrote a manuscript called Black Geniuses. And then all the other... He said, well... I said, are you all aware of how many significant African-Americans there have been? And he wasn't. I remember I said, do you know who Benjamin Banneker was, the mathematician and astronomer? No. The first to die in American Revolution was Crispus Attucks. And then you had the anti-slave orator, great person, Gustavus Vassa, and great explorers, DeSable, the father of American Freemasonry, Prince Hall. He didn't know any of this stuff. He said, man, these are interesting. I said, I was studying every day at the Schoenberg. Are you familiar with Arthur Schoenberg? He was a great biblical scholar and probably the most knowledgeable person in the United States for a long period of time on black culture and history. No. I said, well, that's a movie that you should also do. So he asked me we were sitting one night, we were over at this restaurant, and he said, well, tell us some of the stories. So I remember telling about Nat Turner, who led the rebellion against slavery in Virginia in the 1800s, early 1800s, because he didn't live very long. And I think he was 30 or 31 when he died. And the explorer, James Beckwith, and Sojourner Truth, the abolitionist, civil rights leader, and Catherine Ferguson, and Richard Allen, and the poetess Phyllis Wheatley, and Norbert Rollin, the inventor, and Ira Frederick Aldrich, and who else? Frederick Douglass, of course, and Harriet Tubman, and Hiram Revels, and Blanche Bruce, Lewis Latimer, who I consider the greatest inventor in history. He actually was the first to invent the light. Not Edison, but Edison later bought the rights to him, and he went to work for Edison, so Edison got the credit for it. But it was actually African-American. Granville T. Woods was an inventor. James Jan Matzeliger, he was an inventor. And then you had a great educator who founded Tuskegee University, Booker T. Washington, and Henry Tanner, and Mary Terrell, great civil rights leader, and George Washington Carver, in my opinion, the greatest scientist in history. No one had as many inventions as he did. He saved the South, in fact. And you know that the co-discoverer of the North Pole was an African American, right?
I had no idea. People don't know this stuff, Gary. I can't believe.
Matthew Henson. Yeah. And did you know that there was right at the end of the 1800s, beginning of the 1900s, there was an African-American millionaire? Madam C.J. Walker. And the first black woman to found a bank, to be president of a bank, was Maggie Lena Walker. And the king of ragtime was Scott Joplin. And the great composer of jazz, William Handy. And I think he was in Harlem, was Father Divine, George Baker. So you have these unique people, not just those that you would know, like Jack Johnson, the first black heavyweight, or the first black Rhodes Scholar, Elaine Locke, or the first black general, Benjamin O. Davis. But you had all kinds of individuals throughout history, great composers, William Still, Paul Robeson, Ethel Waters. So I gave him all this information, and we were having this whole discussion, and this went on for several hours. I was talking about all the inventions, blood plasma, the traffic light, the player piano, and and the golf tee, all hundreds of inventions, because I'd just finished the manuscript. And he said, yeah, he said, I'm definitely interested if we can show all the great black minds throughout history. And wouldn't you know it, just 2 weeks before the manuscript was to be finished, he got fired from MGM, and the movie never got done. But then 20 years later, I did Black Hollywood Part 2, because it was evolving, and blacks had more rights, and there was a greater audience, and more of the population were going out to the movies in the African-American community, but to look for and appreciate the unique qualities of the African-American artist. But today, with Tyler Perry and so many other black producers and directors, it's no longer the issue it was, and therefore there's no need for a part three. That's why I haven't done a part three, even though I was asked by my publisher to do a part three. Does that answer the question?
Wow. I don't think anybody knew that about you. That's amazing.
You never know what's behind a door until you open it, right?
Yeah.
And by the way, Luann, I've had hundreds of people call the office after listening to the fundraiser on WBAI where they were mentioning the ozone. And I have no one who can take their calls. Will you take calls and talk with people about ozone therapy?
I will certainly do that.
Okay, because they're overwhelming my switchboard here. So give your number out for people to call you.
Sure. It's 631-504-6198. 631-504-6198. I'll be happy to answer their questions.
Thanks a lot. That's Luann Panessi. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for taking your time to listen. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day. I was born.